Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
A fresh look at the Outer Space Treaty. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Outer Space Treaty was established in 1967 to create a rule of law in space. But now, nearly six decades later, how relevant is it today? A new paper titled Governing Outer Space, a Conference of the Parties for the Outer Space Treaty, explores the idea that the treaty should keep up with today's space age and space policy for the 21st century. We'll speak with Harvard Kennedy School's Eli Sandler to take a fresh look at this treaty and how it can help govern space in the 21st century and beyond. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The Outer Space Treaty was negotiated during the Cold War, as space suddenly became a strategic war frontier. It states that space is the providence of all humankind, and no one country can claim sovereignty over it, or any celestial body. It requires the peaceful usage of space. That means no weapons of mass destruction. And it outlines provisions for nations to help save astronauts should they be in distress while in orbit. The treaty, signed by over 100 signatories, is the backbone of current space law and policy. And some say it's time for an update. That includes Eli Sandler, a fellow at Harvard Kennedy School, who says the treaty doesn't keep up with the times. In his new paper, Governing Outer Space, a Conference of the Parties for the Outer Space Treaty, Eli argues we need to add to the treaty so governments and private companies have a clear understanding of the rules of space. Here to talk more about the paper is Eli Sandler. Eli, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Hey, so before we get into your most recent paper, let's start from the beginning and go back to the creation of the Outer Space Treaty. What is it and what was its intention when it was created decades ago?
So if we think of the Outer Space Treaty, it was signed in the late 1960s. This is the height of the Cold War space race. And both sides, the Russians and the Americans, we know something has to be done to try and de-escalate tension out of space while also still encouraging scientific development, political development, maybe even commercial development. And so the Outer Space Treaty was this Herculean effort where both the Soviets and the Americans came together to try and put in place the rules of the road for what would happen in space. The main focuses were trying to avoid accidents, trying to encourage the liability regime, so you're incentivized to not, you know, hit each other's satellites, and then first steps towards banning nuclear weapons, trying to ensure what is called the peaceful uses of outer space. As I'm sure we'll talk about, this really did lay the foundation, but we didn't really build on those foundations because of subsequent political and other developments in history.
How was the acceptance of the Outer Space Treaty when it was originally created back in the late 1960s? Again, we're in the middle of the space race here, two feuding parties, but was it universally accepted globally?
That question sort of takes the Outer Space Treaty and puts it in today's context, because for the Outer Space Treaty to be universally accepted is a really relevant question today. We have private sector companies going to space. We have everyone from not just the Russians and the Americans, but the Chinese, the Emiratis, the Rwandans, all building a space program. The Outer Space Treaty was signed by the Russians and the Americans, and then the Brits and a few other European countries. And those were the only people that could go to space. So one of the things you'll see in the Outer Space Treaty when you read it, while it does have some rules that you have to authorize all actors going from your territory, if you're a launching state, really it didn't imagine that private companies would be major actors in space. And so this, even though it's sort of under the auspices of the UN, this was really an American and a Soviet treaty. And that's because those were the actors in space. And amongst those two countries, there was a huge amount of support. You can read some of the deliberations both in the United States Senate and then some from the Russian side. And when this was signed, it was very exciting time. They thought this was the beginning of the space age, which it was.
We'll get into kind of the necessity to update this and some of your thoughts on how we can go about doing that. But let's go back to those original signatories, the US and the Soviet Union. Are are those actors still following the provisions in the Outer Space Treaty? Is it still kind of guiding what we do in space?
The short answer is yes. The Outer Space Treaty has some very specific provisions. I'll give you one example. You cannot place weapons of mass destruction in space. Now, if you ask us in America, if you ask the Chinese, if you ask what was the Soviet Union, now the Russians, everyone is very keen to say they are complying with it. And actually, there has been no call from any part of the Outer Space Treaty that's been violated by everyone else. It's really universally agreed that the treaty is followed. What's interesting, though, is what does it mean to place a weapon of mass destruction in outer space? Can you transit a WMD through space? Is that placement in space? What counts as a weapon of mass destruction? These kind of questions mean that even though the treaty is followed by the interpretations of everyone that signed it, actually it's unclear if what the Chinese think they're doing when they comply is the same as what we in America think we're doing when we comply. I'll give you maybe one more example. One of the most contentious issues in the Outer Space Treaty is what's called national appropriation. So the main interpretation of this is I cannot land on the moon, plant my flag, and now say this is new America. But there's an open question of if I land on the moon and I extract some ice or extract some helium-3, can I appropriate those resources? At the time, this was actually left ambiguous because we didn't want to have to agree with it. The two definitions between the Soviets and the Americans. Does using resources on the moon or other parts of outer space, does that constitute the national appropriation that is banned? Now, America, when we signed the Artemis Accords, we explicitly say that use of resources in space is allowed and that it does not constitute national appropriation. And so we are doing something that some people, actually a minority of people, consider to be a violation of the Outer Space Treaty, some legal academics. But we want to be really, really clear, and it's actually in the Artemis Accords, that that complies with the Outer Space Treaty. And so, yes, everyone is saying they're following it. Yes, according to most interpretations, it is being followed. But if we actually want the Outer Space Treaty to do things, to motivate action, to make it safer in outer space, my personal view is we need to get a lot more specific about what it actually means to follow it. That's how we avoid conflict going forward.
Right. It's easy to say you're in compliance when you are the one who is governing yourself, right? You know, compliance is in the eye of the beholder. You know, you've alluded to this, that there need to be some changes or updates to the Outer Space Treaty based upon what is happening in space exploration now. You mentioned there are many governments that are now spacefaring, but also there are private entities that are taking a much greater stake in space exploration and the usage of space. What are some of the gaps that need to be filled when it comes to looking at policies for space in the next decades?
We are, and I am by no means the first person to say this, in a like revolutionary age in terms of access to space from different countries, but also maybe more interestingly, private sector companies that, because of the drastic fall in the price of launch, what I think about in my mind is over $60,000 a kilo with the space shuttle under President Obama, now around $1,000 a kilo to get to low Earth orbit with SpaceX. And the next SpaceX rocket, the Starship, might be $200 or less per kilo, which is roughly the same price as sending something FedEx across the continental United States. And so the amount of stuff we can do in space is exploding. It's not just telecoms anymore. People are thinking about energy in space. We're thinking about biomanufacturing. And that means that there's going to be a lot more stuff in space. There's going to be a lot more satellites. Already there's an exponential increase in the amount of objects that are in both low Earth orbits and other orbits. What does this mean in terms of what we need from governance? The simple thing, and I think it's sort of a tragedy because everyone actually agrees on it, but we can't agree how to make it a rule, is that we need protocols for how we communicate with each other. We need to make sure that my satellite doesn't hit your satellite. We need to make sure that when my satellite ends its useful life, I have a safe path to deorbit it so it can burn up in the Earth's atmosphere. And so I would say that the single most important, and in some ways what should be the easiest thing to agree on in terms of what the Outer Space Treaty should be doing or what international governments should be doing, is trying to make sure we have protocols to avoid collisions in outer space, avoid the creation of more debris, and to deorbit debris when the useful life of the satellite has ended. Maybe I'll demonstrate this one very small anecdote, which really shocked me when I heard it. So I was talking to a really large tech company, a satellite operator. And they say when they have a 1 in 100,000 chance of hitting another satellite, they communicate with that satellite between these two, let's say US companies, and they take maneuvers to avoid each other. If they believe they have a 1 in 100,000 chance of hitting a Chinese satellite, you know what they do? They send a fax to the Chinese National Academy of Sciences. Because we do not have protocols to do this. And at the moment, you know, you see these diagrams of the Earth really crowded with satellites. And actually, you know, those are not to scale. Space is big. So the chances of like cataclysmic collisions right now are small. But as we put more and more things into space, they're going to go up. And so to me, the most important thing by far is what people would call space traffic management and orbital debris decongestion.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eli Sandler. He's a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School about the Outer Space Treaty and policy of space in the 21st century. Eli, in this paper you wrote, you argue that we can kind of get to those goals, right, to better govern space by adding to the Outer Space Treaty with what is called a Conference of Parties. Explain what that is and how that will help us in this governance fix some of these problems or issues that are propping up as we utilize space more and more.
Absolutely. So, well, I'll start by saying this paper that we just published from Harvard, it's by no means meant to be a silver bullet. It's not that, you know, we're hoping that this will happen tomorrow and we solve all the challenges of outer space. But what we noticed is there's huge consensus that while the Outer Space Treaty has been really useful for the growth of the space economy, it needs more. It needs more meat on the bones. We need more governance. But at the same time, even though we agree on many of the things that should be rules of the road for space, for commerce, for different countries, there really is no mechanism to make those universally agreed and followed. So the two ways most people think about creating new international space law is either a new treaty or amending the existing treaty. And that basically doesn't work because we in America, we say, look, we really want to have rules to avoid collisions in space. And then the Chinese will say, okay, well, if we give you that, we want to make sure that you can't put your advanced space weapons in outer orbit. And then one of the developing countries will say, right, but if we give you that, we want to make sure you share all the resources you harvest from the moon. And so even though everyone agrees on a couple things, amending a treaty or passing a new one would require a huge grand bargain. At the same time, the political environment in the United States is such that probably a new treaty would be very hard to get past the Senate. So the traditional means of creating new space law are these grand new treaties that haven't happened for decades. Over the last maybe 5 to 10 years, the other way people have thought about creating new international space law is through something called customary international law. This is basically what the Artemis Accords were trying to do. You say, look, we're going to create voluntary protocols. They're not law. They're not binding. They're not international governance. But if more and more people follow them, they'll become accepted and this will sort of become de facto rules of the road. And there's a legal theory behind the ways in which those customs then become international law. But actually then we see the Artemis Accords, and while they're very, very successful amongst the United States and our partners, they've not been signed by Russia, they've not been signed by China. And those are the two partners actually we need, as I said, to avoid space collisions. And so what we came up with is sort of a third way of creating new rules of the road from the international system, borrowed from other international spheres, other multilateral agreements, particularly the environment. And this is called the Conference of the Parties. And Conferences of the Parties, they exist in a very strange legal gray area. And there's a really interesting body of legal literature about this, which is that every year or 2 years, the parties to a treaty come and they get together. They have a conference. And everything that is said at that conference, everything that is agreed unanimously, it automatically becomes what you can think of as guidance, to use a domestic legislature metaphor, secondary legislation.
So to come, our conversation on the Outer Space Treaty continues.
Every nation right now can say it's complying with that due regard because there's no definition. But we would suddenly have that guidance, what that means. And so what COPs allow you to do is basically to create new international law just by talking to each other without having to have these kind of slowly, softly evolving principles of customary international law, but also without these kind of big bang international agreements.
Diving into the language of the Outer Space Treaty, that's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA. Designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries, beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. The holidays are just around the corner. many of us have our own holiday traditions with both friends and family. The same goes for astronauts living and working in orbit on the International Space Station. We'll hear from one of those astronauts and find out how they celebrate the holidays from space. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we are continuing our conversation about space law and the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. In the treaty, language is used that Eli Sandler, a fellow at Harvard Kennedy School, argues is too vague, making it so there isn't really guidance for nations on how or if they are complying with the treaty. Our conversation with Sandler continues on his paper, Governing Outer Space, a Conference of the Parties for the Outer Space Treaty.
It basically says, for example, the Outer Space Treaty compels countries to give due regard to each other in space. There's no definition of that. And so actually, I can just say I'm giving due regard and no one really knows because there's no legislature, there's no guidance. But if the Conference of the Parties, if all the signatories were to come together and they were to say, they were to deliberate and they were to agree between themselves without passing a new treaty, that they think due regard means having an orbital deorbit plan, or due regard means a certain protocol for communication with other satellites, that would then become the definition of due regard under the Outer Space Treaty. And so in order to comply, and this is what we were talking about at the beginning, every nation right now can say it's complying with that due regard because there's no definition. But we would suddenly have that guidance for what that means. And so what COPs allow you to do is basically to create new international law just by talking to each other without having to have these kind of slowly, softly evolving principles of customary international law, but also without these kind of big bang international agreements. These are very slow. They take a very long time. The most famous conference of the parties to another treaty is in the world of climate. And over the last 30 years, there's been an evolution of climate law. If you compare the way the climate treaty looks, or actually the first COP was from the 70s, it was for the conservation of international wetlands. The body of international law is far, far more evolved and more deep than it was at the time of the signing, even though there have been no new treaties. And that is what we need in space. Again, this isn't a silver bullet. We haven't solved all the issues of international law in places where we have COPs, but it is a space where people can come together, make new rules of the road. Those inform what the private sector can do. Those inform how governments should interact with each other. And they make the space more safe for the actors. And so what we think is, if we were to have a conference of the parties for the Outer Space Treaty, it would provide a first wedge in the door for where we could agree on the things we already agree on, how to deorbit satellites, protocols for communication. And then maybe slowly, slowly over time, as we get to know each other and we deliberate in these environments, we can then address more and more controversial issues of international space law.
In order for that to work, the conference of the parties need to conference. And in this political climate, is that viable? Is there an appetite for you know, these signatories and these actors to come together and sit at the table and actually come up with some of this guidance that you're mentioning?
It's a great question. I will give you my optimistic take and my pessimistic take.
Okay, I like both.
my optimistic take is there are certain subcommittees at the UN where we talk about space issues. It's not that no one is doing any discussion of space anywhere. The problem is that the UN is very, very tainted politically at the moment. It has no enforcement power. These are all, by definition, voluntary. And these are very technical subcommittees. So the negotiators there are not politically empowered, and everyone kind of knows that. However, if you look at these committees, the main one is called the Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space. Actually, we are talking to the Russians and we are talking to the Chinese about space because we know it's important. And we are still cooperating with the Russians on the International Space Station because we have to. And so my optimistic take would be, we know that in space, because it's so crucial, we in the United States, and really this is a Russia, China, US question, we are willing to continue talking to our adversaries because it's so important. And what's more is, unlike, for example, the climate treaties or the international law of the sea, and these are areas where the current administration, the Trump administration, the United States, has really pulled back, space is a little bit different because there is no real cost to compliance. Whatever you think of climate change, and I do a lot of work on climate change, so I think it's really an issue we should be addressing, but there is cost as well as benefits to decarbonization. And so having to comply with UN rules on, let's say, decarbonizing your economy, that comes with huge costs. And the United States has said, we're not willing to bear that for the sake of the international commons. The things that actually have to be done to make space safe are relatively small. And it's really about coordination. And most importantly, the actors that would have to do them, SpaceX, Blue Origin, NASA, they're the ones that directly benefit. And so the tragedy of the commons, in my mind, is actually a lot easier to solve. That's the optimistic case. I think the pessimistic case is that space is an incredibly important national security asset. And it's very, very common to hear in the kind of the corridors of Washington, D.C. nowadays that space is increasingly congested, i.e. we have a lot of satellites up there, and contested. And so we as the predominant space power in the United States are very, very keen to guard our edge. And so we don't want to cede any sovereignty because it might hold back our ability to maintain our competitive edge in space. Again, though, my hope is, if you actually look at what the United States is doing, we are the gold standard in terms of regulation of putting satellites in space, deorbit plans, et cetera. What the FCC is doing and other regulators, we're actually really, really advanced. And so unlike in some other areas where there's worry from the commercial sector in the United States, or there's worry from the government that international regulation would hold back the industry, we would actually do really well out of this kind of thing. And again, that maybe is gives more optimism.
You're listening to Are We There Yet here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eli Sandler, a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, about the Outer Space Treaty and his paper, Governing Outer Space, a Conference on the Parties for the Outer Space Treaty. You mentioned something that struck me as extremely interesting, and it is these private companies benefit from this, right? And I'm thinking that, well, yeah, if I've got, you know, I'm investing millions and millions of dollars in a satellite that I'm putting in orbit that's operational, you know, for a commercial purpose, I don't want another satellite smacking into it or damaging it, right? I mean, they do have so much to gain from this. Is the private company propelling these conversations, or are they kind of pushing the governments for this? And could that be a way that we see kind of action across borders here?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I'll stick with your example. Let's think about the way I would phrase that is liability. So the way I think you solve a lot of the problems of space or tragedy of the commons is you assign really, really clear property rights. And you say, if you destroy my satellite because your satellite broke up and the debris hit me, you owe me a lot of money. And that is going to really economically incentivize people to take care of their deorbits. And actually, technically speaking, there is a whole treaty to do with liability in space. The United States and signatory, it sort of builds on the Outer Space Treaty. But again, that liability regime has actually never been tested. There was one case when a satellite fell out of orbit and hit something on Earth, but it never actually went to court. And so we basically have no test for the liability regime. And if you're a satellite operator, you really want to know that you can insure your satellites. You want to know not only that someone else isn't going to hit you, you want to know what you're on the hook for if you hit someone else. This is how you, as a company, model your risk. And so in the United States, there is real desire, and this is pushed every day in Washington today, for a robust liability regime and regulation on satellites. And actually, one of the big frustrations of the satellite industry in the tech, space tech space, is that the US, even though it's quite good at regulating space, it's sort of a patchwork of regulators. We don't have a single authority that's in charge of this. It's across the FCC, the FAA, et cetera. And so there is a real push towards regulation. So it's not that all the satellite operators sort of want it to be the Wild West out there. The Wild West is really, really bad for business. Whether that translates into desire for international legislation, the answer is not yet, because the only real model we have of what international regulation could look like is this sort of supranational authority where the UN would be empowered to basically make rules. And then the United States' voice in those would be diluted. And so we wouldn't be sure that our satellite companies would be benefiting from the way the regulation happens. So at the moment, there is a lot of skepticism of international regulation, because we're not sure that it could be done in a way that actually benefits US commercial companies. What I think is interesting about the COP model is that you don't actually give any power away. This is still a state-centric model. And so it's not that the United States gives power to a body that can then regulate our satellite industry. It's that we would have a voice and a complete veto, but we would be part of coming up with the rules together. And so I guess to give a much shorter answer to your question, at the moment, yes, there is a huge push from the satellite industry towards more regulation. At the moment, that is domestic regulation because they want to be able to have a say and make sure that the regulation supports the US satellite industry. There's fear that there could be a supranational, like a sort of overall sovereign international regulator. People don't want that. But I'm hoping that this model we're proposing, and I'm sure others will build on it, where the United States would be basically an actor with a veto debating in something like a conference of the parties how international regulation should work, that really does closely align with what a lot of U.S. satellite industry is asking for.
Finally, Eli, is it going to take a catastrophe for action to happen here? I mean, we haven't really seen, satellite collisions just yet. There have been intentional debris-making events, but there have been some close calls and all that. But is it going to take something bad happening in space for this to get additional momentum?
So this is the question people ask a lot in a lot of things. People ask it about AI. Is it going to take a catastrophe in AI to get regulation? And actually, I'm more optimistic. Let's return to your first question of the interview. How did the Outer Space Treaty get signed? And it was not because of a catastrophe. It was because there was enough pressure from all the domestic constituent parts of the political system, of the economic system, that made this happen. And so I think and I hope that actually kind of the point you picked up on, which is as we use space more, we need to know the rules of the road. We need to know the rules of the road internationally because more Chinese constellations are going up. We need to know the rules of the road commercially because we want to be able to insure our satellites and insure that they have liability protection. I don't think that a collision in space is what's going to be the catalyst for this. I think if we go to the moon, some of the voices are going to realize we have to have a way of operating with the Chinese there. We have to know how close you can get to each other's bases. So I'm optimistic, but that's exactly what we're trying to prevent with this kind of work from orbit.
And we need to make sure we still have a fax machine, right?
Just in case.
We'll be speaking with Eli Sandler. He's a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. His latest paper is Governing Outer Space, a conference of the parties for the Outer Space Treaty. We'll link that on our website. Eli, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you think you might make a good guess, well, reach out to us. We always want to hear from you. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.